Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can get our weekly newsletter for $3 a month and unlock bonus episodes for $5 a month. You'll also get access to ad-free versions of the podcast. We recently released bonus episodes on No Time to Die and Lamb, and we'll be dropping one soon on the David Lynch Dune and the new season of Succession. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps,
Genevieve Kosky,
and Tasha Robinson.
So last week, I had the pleasure of heading out into a rain-slickened noir evening and seeing a 35mm print of the new Edgar Wright film Last Night in Soho at the Music Box Theater here in Chicago, along with a nice crowd of fully vaccinated people. And I thought, there's no better time to be alive than in the year 2021. I think we can all agree on that, right?
I don't know.
And yet, like Thomasin McKenzie in that movie, I couldn't help but fantasize about going back in time to the 1960s, stepping into an old-fashioned single-screen movie palace and experiencing some of the great films of the period when they came out.
Well, yeah. We just did Lawrence of Arabia last week. It would have been pretty special to see the premiere of that one.
And from that same time period, you got the huge influx of movies from the French New Wave, like Breathless and Jules and Jim and Fellini's 8½ and La Dolce Vita, plus Buñuel and Antonioni.
Yeah, I can imagine being there for the first showing of 2001 A Space Odyssey, or Kurosawa's Yojimbo and High and Low, or The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, for that matter.
Then there's Redline 7000, Pocketful of Miracles, Skidoo.
Hold up. Howard Hawks, Frank Capra, and Otto Preminger are all great directors, but even their most ardent defenders would never consider those among their best films.
So I'm aware of that now, but I would have been really excited to see those films in the 60s. I wouldn't have known in advance how they turned out.
So your fantasy is to go back in time 60 years and see a bunch of really disappointing films by masters past their prime?
You underestimate how much I just like going to the movies, Genevieve. Plus, being disappointed by the 60s is what the Edgar Wright film is all about. Tasha, want to tell us about this week's pairing?
Sure. Last Night in Soho is about an aspiring designer from the British countryside who travels to London to attend fashion school, where she dreams of reviving the looks from the swinging 60s. Those dreams turn extremely vivid when she's transported back to the 1960s and becomes infatuated with a glamorous would-be lounge singer. As things in her dream world take a dark turn into sexual violence and possible murder, the two timelines start to converge, as do the two women, who begin to resemble each other in uncanny ways. This immediately brought us back to Ingmar Bergman's Persona, one of the most talked about films of his career and of the 60s in general. Persona merges the lives of two very different people. One a revered stage actress who suddenly goes silent and motionless during a performance, the other a humble young nurse assigned to take care of her at a seaside retreat. But as they get to know each other, the film deliberately confuses their stories and identities and deconstructs the medium itself in the process.
So this week, we'll dig into Persona and see if we can scratch the surface of one of cinema's most mysterious and scrutinized movies. And then next week, we'll jump ahead to the present day, then back again to the 60s for another intense psychodrama, Last Night in Soho. Please join us.
In these words, the leading film critics of Europe have honored Ingmar Bergman's new film, Persona. Persona is a knowledge, a terrible knowledge of our loneliness, our estrangement, our inability to reach one another. It is a confession of our fears, of man, of failure, of death. Persona is the drama of a despair. A silence. A terror far too great to be named. Of life laid bare to the bone.
Ingmar Bergman did not have anything to prove when he made Persona in 1966. After all, he had just wrapped up the Faith trilogy of Through a Glass Darkly, Winter Light, and The Silence, and he'd spent the previous decade making one masterpiece after another, including the 1-2-3 of Smiles of a Summer Night, The Seventh Seal, and Wild Strawberries. He was revered worldwide for the psychological intensity and aesthetic rigor of his work, his insight into human relationships, and his subtle, decade-spanning innovation of the form. He was even capable of making a good comedy on occasion. And yet, he surely felt he needed to prove himself. South of his native Sweden, Europe was exploding with filmmakers who were revolutionizing the medium, like Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut in France, Federico Fellini and Michelangelo Antonioni in Italy, and Louis Buñuel in Spain. And those revolutions were coinciding with generational turbulence in culture and politics, too. In that context, Bergman was at risk of seeming ossified and irrelevant, an aging master working from his little island in the Baltic Sea, oblivious to a world that was threatening to pass him by. Persona changed that perception faster than you can say Brechtian alienation strategy. The opening 7 minutes of the film are unlike any he had attempted before. A flurry of highly charged and symbolic images that begin with the self-reflexive touch of film inside a projector and culminates in the haunting image of a young boy reaching toward a woman's face in the projected image, a desire to touch someone who isn't physically present. In between, Bergman shocks us with flashes of dying humans and sheep, of a crucifixion, of an erect penis, images made more disturbing by a loud, arrhythmic score. Even for a director who had once had a man literally play chess with death, there was a lot of wild imagery to unpack here. Persona eventually settles into what seemed like a more familiar Bergman psychodrama, but even that starts to take a turn for the abstract. In the first of what would become a 10-film collaboration with Bergman, Liv Ullmann stars as Elizabeth Vogler, a stage actor who simply and suddenly goes silent in the middle of a performance, as if something has snapped inside her. Even though Elizabeth's not speaking and not really moving either, her doctor comes to the rather dubious medical conclusion that nothing is wrong with her mentally or physically, and perhaps all she needs is some time away at the doctor's seaside retreat to recuperate. Somebody, I think, needs to make a side quill about this doctor. Elizabeth's nurse is a sunny young woman named Alma, played by B.B. Anderson, who is asked to join her on this weekend away. The two women bond in sunny weather, and Alma enjoys the opportunity to use the silent, attentive Elizabeth as a sounding board for some very personal stories. One such story is about an afternoon spent sunbathing in the nude with a woman she has just met named Katerina. When two curious boys start ogling them, Katerina surprised Alma by initiating a sexual encounter that left Alma pregnant. Since she was engaged, she opted to have an abortion, which left her with feelings of guilt. The relationship turns when Alma happens to open an unsealed letter written by Elizabeth that includes all of these very personal details from Alma's life, which understandably leaves Alma feeling betrayed. The sudden animosity between them seems to trigger a transformation, specifically when Elizabeth's husband mistakes Alma for his wife on a visit. The two seem alike somehow, and Alma voices a story of an unwanted pregnancy of Elizabeth's that seems to be a mirror image of her own, and ties all the way back to that early shot of the boy reaching for the woman's face. There's a lot to unpack in Persona, the Mount Everest of cinematic analysis, but what's surprising about the film is how purposeful and clearly articulated it is at its core, particularly the character of Alma, whose vulnerabilities are so nakedly exposed. Bergman, too, wants the audience to know that he's open to the world, which is why he's included footage of a man's self-immolation in Vietnam, and an image of Polish Jews captured after the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. He's also open to cinema, which we can see in a framing device that makes us aware that we are watching a movie. He's also open to interpretation, which we'll try to do after the break.
Du, Elisabeth, jag har tänkt på en sak. Jag tycker inte det är någon idé att du är kvar på sjukhuset längre. Jag tror bara du tar skada av att vara här. Eftersom du vill fara hem så föreslår jag att du och syster Alma, ni kan flytta ut på mitt sommarställe vid havet. Va? Tror du inte jag förstår? Den hopplösa drömmen om att vara. Inte verka, utan vara. I varje ögonblick medveten, vaksam. Och samtidigt avgrunden mellan vad du är inför andra och vad du är inför dig själv. Svindelkänslan och den ständiga hungern att äntligen få bli avslöjad. Jag får bli genomskådad, reducerad, kanske till och med utplånad.
So, you know, the usual opening question, what's your history with Persona and how does it hold up in the year 2021?
I saw Persona for the first time almost exactly 20 years ago in a college course that was either a psychology course or a modernism course. And I don't know which. And I think it could easily have been either based on the fact that we watched this film in it. And I think maybe it was a censored version. I don't know. There was some stuff this time that I definitely didn't recall from that first viewing. So I don't know if we saw like a safe for students version or if I just, I don't know, forgot. But point is, I didn't have like a super strong memory of the events of the film, because I think the events of the film are not like necessarily memorable on their own. It's more like the feeling of the film that sticks with you. And it did to a certain extent, but I think even more than that, what stuck with me in the 20 years between viewings is just the sense that this is a difficult film. Difficult maybe is an unfair word, but it's
I don't know why that's unfair, but sure.
Well, it's a film that I think you can get lost in the analysis thereof, you know, and yet there, especially if you are a person who is, you know, drawn to narrative and, you know, to plot. And I think this is something that will maybe come up when we talk about the Edgar Wright film a bit too. But, you know, if you're someone who like kind of attaches to that, it's not a film that, you know, is easy to process. And I think it's appropriate that my only experience before this was in a classroom and academic setting that was primed for, you know, analysis. It is literally shown to us to teach us how to analyze it, you know. So it's a film that I think functions in that way. But watching it this time, I think I was able to maybe get lost in it a little more, not worry so much about, you know, solving it or, you know, coming up with an idea that can be a 5.5 page double-spaced paper by the end of the week about it, you know. I just have to record a podcast about it. I used to talk about it with my much smarter friends and see what they think. Wait,
do you do another podcast or something?
Come on, guys. I need you to explain Persona to me. No, I don't need you to explain Persona to me. I think is what I'm getting at. Like, I don't think it is useful to kind of pick apart like an answer to this film. But I think it is useful to like delve into the imagery and ideas and emotions of this film.
Yeah, I also saw this film about 20 years ago. I'm sure I would have gotten to it otherwise, but I also saw it indirectly as part of the class, because it was part of a class that my wife was taking on Scandinavian cinema, which was a class that she enjoyed, and I sort of enjoyed by association because I watched a bunch of movies with her. And it is, you know, it's, you know, I'd seen a bunch of Bergman from before this, though not immediately before this. Some of his more famous films from the early 60s remain a big blind spot for me, and I've seen Bergman from after this. But this was kind of squarely in the middle of a bunch of Bergman I hadn't seen. But even saying that, it's really different from any other Bergman movie I'd seen before or since. It is such a strikingly different film. And I was really surprised by how much I'd kind of like what you're saying, Genevieve, where the general impressions of the film remained very strong with me. But the specifics of what happened and what happens when within the movie had kind of blurred over. And I'm not even sure it takes 20 years to do that. I think I could probably say it about I watched it last week. I could probably say it about it just a week out from it too. And I think that's part of the elusiveness of this film, which I find pretty remarkable. I always thought of it as sort of like Bergman is huge in the 50s and the French New Wave happened, and the other New Waves happened, but the French New Wave is especially. And then I think this is kind of his whole Mayakovich moment. It's like, here, I'll show you just how much a film can eat itself. It's a remarkable film in that way.
Yeah, of all the films we've talked about, this one seems least relevant to talk about what it looks like in 2021, just specifically because there's nothing about it. You know, there's close of the era and environs of the era, and maybe even attitudes of the era. But the narrative itself doesn't feel particularly attached to a time. It's such an abstract, it's such a deconstruction that these people don't feel like people of a time. They feel like symbols, like conceptual ideas that keep mutating as the movie goes on.
I'll push back just a little bit on that, because there are some very specific references to Vietnam. You know, that seems to be a part of what sends Elizabeth into such a deep remove as well. But I think you're right in general. You could probably drop in a contemporary reference if you're setting this film today, and it would work just as well.
Yeah, but I mean, there's also a very prominent reference to the atrocities of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Like the sense is more about the atrocities of man's inhumanity to man than about this being a Vietnam era film specifically, or in response to anything that happened in relationship to protests in Vietnam. Like, as you say, there could just as well be a scene from the January 6th insurrection put in here, and it would kind of feel like it all had the same meaning. It's just the things that Elizabeth is recoiling from in humanity don't necessarily need to be tied to a specific time and place, I think. I don't remember where I first encountered this film. In keeping with the design of Persona, I want to say that I first saw it in college, and also that I saw it first wandering into a theater from the rain in New York City, and it was playing instead of Home Alone for some inexplicable reason. And I'm also going to say that I encountered it for the first time after Scott reviewed it for The Dissolve, and I sought it out and watched it. So all of those things are equally true, and none of them is true. And you can just keep on guessing. But I mean, I have seen it before, and I've had the same experience everybody is describing. It's a very elusive film. It's hard to hold in your head for long. And part of that is just the lack of linearity of it. Like, I think if you showed any segment of this film to somebody, especially people in film class, and said, what's this film about? They would have a very cogent, specific answer about who these women are in relation to each other, and like what kind of Jungian tale is unfolding in terms of which one of them is clearly real and which one of them is representative of some sort of shadow self. But the scenes don't necessarily fit together in a way that supports any one reading. There's just never any sense that you're watching the same story necessarily that you were a minute ago. So, like, I think the quote about, like, all interpretations of this movie are equally true is maybe overstating the case a little bit. But I think that you could sit down and write a 50-page scholarly paper on how Alma is having a breakdown and imagining Elizabeth. And you could just as easily write a 50-page paper on how Elizabeth is having a breakdown and imagining Alma, much as the philosopher who has everyone turn on him in ridicule when he says that he has just proven the existence of God, and he could just as easily prove the unexistence of God. I think people would probably turn on you no matter what you said, but, you know, all things are sort of equally true here.
As far as my history with Persona, I think you'd have to go back to college, where I was just, you know, in my immersive phase of seeing every possible thing at the library, and obviously Bergman films were well represented, you know, in the library at that point. And I think I went through them, I don't know if I went through them cognizantly as, you know, in order, but I think I watched them in a way that you probably would if you're doing kind of an intro to Bergman. I feel like The Seventh Seal was something I started with, and I started pretty early with Wild Strawberries and Smiles of a Summer Night and your real canonical classics, and came to Persona a little bit later. And the thing that makes me kind of that's kind of funny now in retrospect is that when I was in college, my favorite Bergman film was Wild Strawberries, a film about you know, a guy who's, you know, getting old and kind of, you know, dreaming about and lamenting his lost youth. And that was weird. That was the film I connected to strongly in college. And now as a grown-up, Persona is clear to me like the best thing he's ever done. I mean, that's the one that this one just blows me away. So I have no, I can't really account for that. But yeah, obviously I think it holds up in the year 2021. And of course you can see its influence everywhere. You know, I mean, you know, David Lynch, for one, I think would be, I don't think we'd see some of the types of things we've seen from David Lynch films like Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive and Twin Peaks and that sort of thing without persona, I think. That's just one guy, but there's a lot of this kind of doubling effect. And I mean, the Vertigo has it too, but this is a very forward thinking and influential film. And I think it's got a real power to it. I mean, maybe it is a defiant of an analysis, or maybe you can come up with different takes that are maybe contrary to another take. But to me, the emotional core of the film is pretty well articulated and strong. You know, once you get past that first 7 minutes, and you also get rid of the last couple of minutes, I mean, you have, you know, really, you know, the stuff at the, you know, seaside home, you know, at least for a good stretch is very clear and compelling and emotional, and, you know, and just, you know, and it feels very almost kind of meat and potatoes Bergman in terms of, you know, psychological drama, you know, and there were things that he would do later on. I mean, I think it's The Passion of Anna that had a lot of like references to war and things like that in it. Have you seen that one? Anyone seen that one?
I haven't seen that
Passion
one.
Yeah. I think that kind of opened things up a little bit to what was going on in the world, which was kind of an unusual thing for a Bergman film to do. You know, in a film like Cries and Whispers has a pretty similar intensity and kind of a focus on faces and composition, a really rigorous composition, or similar compositions, I guess, to Persona. So he was really developing into something here. This was both a radical departure and also kind of a transitional film for him. But I think it's just, it's absolutely fascinating. It's fun to try to work your mind around as a intellectual exercise, but I think it kind of hits you right in the gut too. And there are monologues in this film and images in the film. I mean, I think Sven Nykvist's photography is just staggeringly beautiful, that really get you on a very emotional level, you know, beyond, you know, scratching your chin over, you know, over whatever paper you might be writing about it. I think it does have a power to it.
Can I give my super hot take on this film?
Yeah.
I don't think that Elizabeth and Alma look that much alike.
Like, no, neither does Mike D'Angelo. He wrote a review about this film.
Really?
Like, yeah.
This may be the first and only time Mike D'Angelo and I have ever agreed on anything in film. But
no.
I'm in the same boat there. Both in terms of thinking they don't look much alike, which I'm actually glad for, because you know, when Bergman's playing tricks with time and identity, being able to tell them apart kind of tells me when he's playing tricks. If they looked exactly alike, I think you could have the same action of this film and it wouldn't necessarily register when they're trading places, when it's, you know, the wrong quote unquote person in a given scene. So I think that the symbolism of Alma believing that she looks like Elizabeth, I mean, she has that moment where she says like, oh, you know, I think we look so much alike, teehee, she says, comparing herself to an extremely famous actress. And then she immediately pulls back and is like, you know, you're much more beautiful. But, you know, the degree to which she sees herself mirrored in Elizabeth, I think is one of the biggest themes of the movie. She projects all of these things onto her when Elizabeth doesn't speak. You know, she stops seeing her as a person and starts seeing her as like everything she wants her to be. This like endlessly receptive, like friendly, loving, caring ear who to take on all of her weight and give her back unconditional love. And she's so outraged when she finds that Elizabeth is a person and still has opinions and is thinking about things other than what Alma's projected. So I think that, you know, we look exactly alike thing is just another form of projection. And it's intended to some degree to be a reflection of the fact that they're just spending so much time alone with each other. Like she's kind of lost a bit of her identity and is just seeing herself as, you know, fully equal to this incredibly famous artist. But, you know, Bergman's opinion on them looking exactly alike aside, I don't think the rest of us are meant to.
Well, I think there's something to the fact that Elizabeth's an actress as well. And there's something, maybe a commentary here about almost the predatory nature of acting, of this woman who is silently observing Alma, and Alma taking that as being a sort of sympathetic attention, when in fact she's, you know, learning things that she's going to repurpose in a way that Alma does not approve of. That seems like a very actorly thing to do.
It also feels like a little bit of something a film director would do too, a little bit of misplaced or guilt that's been placed on another profession that any artist who draws on the people around them has to feel a little bit.
Yeah, I definitely read their relationship more in the vein of what Scott's talking about. Like, Elizabeth struck me as a very active, passive presence. I feel like their conversations, even though Alma is like kind of like, you know, she's very open, she's a chatterbox, I do kind of get the impression in those moments that Elizabeth is taking something from that interaction more than Alma is giving something, especially in the pivotal scene when Alma tells her story about sunbathing on the beach. And she's like, she's very drunk. She's kind of lost herself. And the look on Elizabeth's face as she listens does kind of feel like she is absorbing Alma to a certain extent, taking her in a way that I think can be read, you know, a little nefarious. I definitely felt it that way on this viewing for whatever reason. I think it can also be read in exactly the opposite way, as we have said multiple times on this episode already. But as far as, you know, looking at it as an actor observing someone and taking what they observe to incorporate into a role, I think that squares with the idea that Elizabeth has gone silent because she is no longer has a role to play. She is maybe like looking for a new role or persona to form and to take from Alma in a way.
I mean, I think it's very significant that we get that one scene of Alma sort of opening her wrist and allowing Elizabeth to feed on her blood like a vampire, or forcing her sort of in the middle of that shot. She grabs a hold of her head and the nature of the dynamic seems to change. So exactly what that relationship is to both of them, you know, they're kind of multiple interpretations, even in the middle of a single shot. Mm-hmm. But it does seem very much like in that moment after Alma makes her long and teary confession and breaks down, the look on Elizabeth's face is not comforting or sad or empathetic. She looks satisfied. She looks like she's just had a really good meal. She's got this little Mona Lisa smile on her face as she pets Alma's head that just really kind of speaks to being replete more than it speaks to helping somebody through a crisis.
I mean, it's amazing how good Liv Ullmann is in this movie. And that, I mean, that is a character that doesn't really speak much at all, but like leaves such an impression just through that, those expressions, through that level of attention. But I don't want to get, before we get too ahead of ourselves, I want to go dial back a little bit to ask your response to the famous opening minutes and what your like visceral reaction to that was, and then what you significance I think you might assign to the drama that follows.
I mean, I took it as a personal affront that it starts with an image of a spider, but
a big hairy spider, too.
It's a gnarly spider. So I didn't appreciate that. But I was watching this with my husband, who had not seen it before, and he was fully unprepared for that opening, and I think was very concerned about what was to follow based on that, because if you don't know that that's not the whole movie, I think it's very jarring and upsetting. But I mean, it's jarring and potentially upsetting even if you do know that. I mean, the score alone I think is very off-putting and purposely so, not to mention the imagery that accompanies it. But I don't really know what to make of it in sort of a broader analytical sense, other than sort of the obvious connection between like cinematic imagery and the actual like going inside a film. And of course the boy in the hospital reaching toward the projection of the woman is a very obvious like cinema screen type of image. But as far as like the spider and the sheep's eye and the erect penis, that all is a little more confounding to me.
Well, it's all hostile and discordant, and
hostile's a good word.
And like, if you just the projector, coming to life is itself, you know, a really upsetting image in some way, and it's parallel. It's bookended at the end of the film by the light dimming, but it also, it just, to me, I think it kind of sets this tone of artistic creation as an act of violence or aggression. And I think, you know, you get that one shot of Bergman and Nykvist on the crane, and it's kind of menacing. I mean, they're not menacing looking people particularly, but the way that's filmed, you know, it's like you're looking at, because you're watching the people who make the movie, it's like you're looking at something you're not supposed to be looking at. It is, there's something distant and forbidding about it, in the same way that the boy reaching for the screen and you know, these images that he'll never actually be able to touch, but can only kind of look at and interpret. And somehow it kind of gets at the heart of what it is to watch a movie in a way that doesn't necessarily make you feel comfortable about the act of watching movies.
Yeah, there's something almost relentless about it. The cuts back and forth to the film spooling through the projector just kind of hint at, you know, you're seeing these unpleasant things, a giant hairy spider and a giant hairy scrotum and this sheep being bled out, or maybe it's a goat, it's hard to tell, like the struggling sheep. As its blood is pouring into a bucket. But all of these things whisk by, and then you keep cutting back to the projector as if to be reminded that the projector doesn't care what runs through it. You know, the projector is a device that has no ability to like pause at atrocity or pause at something lurid or pause at something unexpected. You know, I don't know how common naked erections were in Swedish cinema at the time. You know, they're still not at all common in modern cinema. That's just sort of a shocking thing. But the projector doesn't pause. The projector is completely indifferent to what it's offering up. And that seems like a pretty cynical look at cinema. But the score and the like relentless strobing, the kind of head-hurting strobing of light during all of this reminded me an awful lot of Gaspar Noé's Irreversible and the place that that film ends in just a kind of a discordant light show of trying to unsettle everybody as much as possible on the way out the door. The business with the sheep bleeding out and then that last squirmy close-up of somebody reaching to touch its eyeball just reminded me a lot of Buñuel's Chien de Lu, with the eyeball being slit.
It's because that footage is from when Chien de Lu.
So long since I saw that film. I did not know that at all. That's...
You don't revisit that weekly?
If I were to revisit YouTube. It, I would certainly do so in the weakest way possible. So wait, are any of those other cuts, like, to your knowledge, from other movies?
I'm not sure. I know that because of Wikipedia, but that is where that's from. And similarly, Genevieve, you're right. You did see a censored version of this. The erect penis was cut from, so to speak, from US and UK prints, and the very graphic description of the orgy was selectively translated in English.
That definitely squares with my memory then. Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember being that explicit. And I remember this is explicit as the beginning of Godard's Weekend, which now I realize was kind of a take on this scene as well. But anyway, that's a whole other movie to get into.
It's interesting to see, you know, Bergman kind of engaging with the other Europeans at this with this film too. I mean, I think that was kind of the point in a way of making Persona. It is just to kind of feel like he was part of that wave of cinema that was happening around him. As far as this opening goes, I mean, a couple of my takeaways from it is I think any time that you have any kind of self-reflexivity with a camera, with a projector, it is to remind the audience of the essential artifice and illusion of the medium, and the fact that to be aware that you expect to be manipulated a little bit. So I think it's kind of softening us up for sort of the abstract convergence, I guess, that we experience later in the movie. And the other part of it is I think that the boy in the projected image kind of gets reflected back upon later in the movie with regard to Elizabeth's son and her feelings about having a child and her feelings of disconnect from that boy who must feel, you know, in every way like he is trying to reach her and, you know, who loves his mother and who is not getting the love back that he desires. It seems like those two things are related, at least to my mind.
Yeah. I definitely felt that too, to the point where I kind of felt the temptation to literalize that opening a bit as being an illustration of Elizabeth's breakdown of what happens to her that makes her stop speaking. I don't think it quite works because she's not a film actress, right? She's a stage actress.
But there's reference to her appearing in a film at least. I think she's primarily known for her stage work.
Right. Okay. But I feel like, you know, if you wanted to go that route and kind of look at this like assault of images and pain through the context of a camera or of an audience, of a viewer, and then it kind of culminating in that shot of the boy that seems like a very direct reference to her son that we hear about later. It does seem that this kind of opening turmoil could be sort of an evocation of what happened to land her there. I don't know how strongly I feel about making that declaration, but like I said, the presence of the boy in relation to what we know about Elizabeth's son definitely made me want to kind of try to.
I mean, it's also just an evocation of sort of the artificiality of cinema in terms of here are a bunch of images that don't connect, but you're going to try to connect them, you know, in the same way the brain connects a bunch of photographs that are run by them very quickly into the illusion of motion, which makes cinema possible. You know, it's a documented effect. If you show somebody a bunch of unrelated images, their brains will try to assemble them into some sort of story, will try to make meaning out of the sequence. And it's far from the first time the movie makes you conscious that you're watching a movie. It's far from the first time that it kind of makes a break to remind you of the artificiality of cinema. But why he leads with that, unless he's trying to kind of jolt people out of complacency, so they'll have a little more, you know, I also, at the point where the film breaks down and melts, I did kind of think a little bit, I guess Gremlins 2 is a reference point for a lot of people there. But
you could go Tulane Blacktop if you wanted.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of too.
Now, what it made me think of more than anything else was Haneke's Funny Games. Mm. And like, that movie doesn't give you a lot of like lead in or tease or awareness of what kind of trickery it's going to be up to later. You know, here from the start, like, this is an artificial and conscious and filmic experience. So when things break down, it's maybe less of a surprise or less of a narrative disjunct. It's just kind of like, oh, we're kind of stepping back to this then.
Not to sidetrack too much, but I did finally make it all the way through Funny Games after on my third attempt, I think. Like I saw the dog. I knew the general purpose of the film. Like, nope, not tonight. But I did finally.
Well, now you got to watch the American version.
I hear they're very different.
You super do not have to watch the American version. You don't have to do anything.
I'm kind of curious about it though.
Those movies.
It's good. It's like it's in English, except it's Funny Games. So I don't know. Yeah, the thing, hearing everyone speak about the opening and, you know, and about different interpretations of it, is like, what's interesting to me about it is that it is, of course, endlessly analyzable, but Persona watching at this time, is what gets you is just how much of an impact it has, how much of an emotional response or you have as a viewer to it. It really has a lot of teeth to it, a lot of bite. And I almost think that is kind of what Bergman was going for here, to try to shake things up, to try to, you know, he had just made, you know, this God Silence trilogy, which were three extraordinarily good but also extraordinarily austere dramas about faith. And I think that this was his opportunity to kind of like shake his audience up a little bit and shake up the scene. And I don't know, there's something just so exciting about watching it even before you start to, you know, try to wrap your brain around what is actually happening and what all of it means.
I don't know that that's true for me. I think that this, so many of these individual scenes, when they're allowed to play out at any length, they build up such emotional power. The interaction between the two women in various emotional conditions, you know, there's the root of a really terrifying, like, Hitchcockian thriller in here about a woman who, you know, is suffering, and then her caretaker goes mad and assaults her. but we kind of cut away from that and go in a completely different direction. There's a story in here about a woman who like invents a persona for herself to make her incredibly dull life bearable, and invents herself this like incredibly glamorous person who she has to take care of, but then gets jealous of. You know, there's a whole bunch of different, you know, as I say, you cut out one of these scenes and you hand it to somebody and say, what's the rest of this movie about? You're going to get 20 different movies. But for me, the disjuncts where we move away from one of these stories into one that's not compatible with whatever we just saw in a strictly linear narrative fashion kind of undercuts some of the drama and some of the emotion. It's returning to that artificiality of cinema in a way that kind of repeatedly makes me go, well, okay, but I wanted to see what was going to happen in that story. Like, take me back to the story that you were just telling where this is true and this is true. And it has, and you've built up a great deal of narrative power instead of kind of rewinding to undo all of that and do this other thing instead.
Yeah, I guess that kind of, it leads to that question about that, I guess, convergence point, right? Because after Alma reads the letter and has the reaction that she has to it, and things really, really come to a head to where she's almost going to throw, you know, boiling hot water in Elizabeth's direction. You know, the film then starts to kind of shift into something else. And I guess for you, Tasha, it seems to have some of its power has waned in that decision, which is a decision to, you know, on Bergman's part to do something else. And there's an artistic reason for that. But I'm curious to hear what others thought about how that convergence point is handled both dramatically and visually.
I mean, I think one way of reading this is as a power struggle. And I think there's, you know, there is a balance of power that shifts between these two women. And that convergence that you're speaking of is a point where perhaps that's not even what the emphasis is anymore. But I do think the end of the film, I guess I don't want to jump ahead and talk about the end yet, but I don't know if we want to read the end as sort of a final judgment on who wins that power struggle or not.
Before we get to the ending, I kind of want to get everyone's thoughts in relation to what Scott's asking about the double monologue. When we hear about, we hear Elizabeth's story and we hear it twice from two different angles. It sounds like from the light reading up I did that was not initially planned. You know, it was filmed twice, as is pretty standard for something like that. But rather than, you know, choosing a take or mixing the takes together, Bergman just put them both back to back. And I don't know, I feel like that maybe muddles whatever is happening as far as their convergence more than it illuminates anything for me. I don't know. I don't know if I actually like that move that much. So I'm curious what others think of it.
Well, I think it kind of connects to the whole self-awareness and you know, self-referentiality that starts to begin and ends the film and kind of runs throughout it. But it's like, what is your reaction based on whether you're watching the speaker or the person reacting to the story? And you know, you have to, it kind of heightens the artificiality of it, but also kind of forces you to examine how film makes you feel based on what it shows you.
It also seems like it makes you examine kind of how each of them are performing, not the actresses, but the characters themselves. You know, during the course of that conversation, or really that one-sided monologue, both of them are experiencing things, and we're kind of zooming in on what that is. But I don't know. I mean, for me, the most insightful part of the movie comes fairly early on when that doctor that Scott was so fascinated with talks about how she understands perfectly what Elizabeth's problem is. And it's basically just the artificiality of living, the difficulty of knowing that you're presenting yourself at all times, that living is living out a role, and that she's kind of consciously taken a step back from that because she's to some degree overthinking herself and doubting the reality of everything she says and thinks and does. So when we take this moment to like watch them both close up as they carry through this fairly significant moment for both of them, we're watching their particular roles that they're playing and how those roles different, how their response is different, how their faces are different, how each beat of the story affects them very differently from each other. And again, it's kind of a step outside of the narrative illusion of filmmaking in a way that undercuts the drama for me. It's a really interesting choice because it's not one that you see often. And I think anything unique can be really interesting in cinema. But it doesn't work for me as far as like forwarding the actual drama, whatever that drama is, forwarding whatever connection is between them. Because in this case, they're wholly separate. It feels mm-hmm. like either of them could be sort of a weird thing to say since Elizabeth's just receiving it. But it feels like a stage monologue, you know, an audition monologue, almost distanced from everything around it, just kind of presented as a high quality piece of stagecraft, but very consciously a piece of stagecraft.
And I think there's kind of something to where Bergman is just painting this beautiful canvas that he keeps slashing over and over again, you know? I mean, like, because I think there is a film in here, or maybe multiple films that are on their own in a very straightforward way, in a very Bergman-like way, would be, you know, immensely satisfying and interesting to dig into. I mean, just that, you know, incredible monologue that Alma gives about her encounter with Katerina and the boys and all that other stuff. I mean, that is, that alone, there's something so much to kind of unpack about her feelings about that. And then also about, if we could hear from Elizabeth, her feelings of maternal ambivalence, the kind of interesting mirrors, the interesting way that those different recollections, stories sort of rhyme, could be conventionally quite compelling as, you know, what we might expect from Bergman. But then Bergman has this impulse with this movie from the start to double and to slash and to, you know, to kind of shake things up, you know, in a way that's, you know, artistically compelling and very disturbing, but maybe not as satisfying.
Doubles and slashing. It really sounds like you're moving us into our next film here, Scott.
Yeah, you know what? I think maybe I am. There's just, again, an endless amount to talk about with Personas, but we're not done talking about it. We will come back to Persona next week when we deal with Last Night in Soho. But for now, it's time for feedback. Now it's time for feedback, where we answer any questions and respond to any comments about our episodes or anything else in the world of film. First up, we get to talk about Dune some more, which I always like. Genevieve, do you want to read this one?
Sure. Kyle in Chicago offered a few comments on Dune, but we'll focus on two. He writes, "Thank you for the great episodes on Lawrence of Arabia and Dune." You're welcome. Thank you, Kyle. He continues, "I had some thoughts about your Dune discussion in particular that I'd be interested to hear you all talk about a bit. I've only read the book once, but from what I remember, Liet Kynes may be the second most important character after Paul in terms of the future of Arrakis, because she/he lays the plans that eventually make it a fertile world, per the appendices. So it feels like the gender and race swap in the film is a small switch narratively that has pretty significant meaning for fans of the book, which I thought was interesting. You all talked about wishing the movie had an intermission and then continued with part two. But after my first viewing, I really felt like this adaptation should have been done in three parts, as the book is. To me, it felt as though the film had a finale, with the assault by the Harkonnens and Sardaukar on the palace, and then a wind down that should have led into an ending. But instead, it continues for another half hour to 40 minutes. I'd love the first hour and 40 minutes to 2 hours, which covers the story in part one of the book, and then was exhausted by the fact that it kept going on for far too long after what felt like a brilliant climax, narratively and spectacle-wise. I also think it hurts that nothing in that final stretch is as visually stunning as everything that comes before. P.S. If you could let me know where to see it in full IMAX in Chicago, I would be extremely grateful, because I haven't been able to figure out what theaters have full IMAX and what's just on a big letterboxed screen.
I'll answer that question. Yes. None of them. There's no Zero. Real. I mean, those are probably really nice big screens, and not a bad way to see the movie. But we're IMAX-less in Chicago.
Nice big surcharge is what it is.
I don't know. I saw it at the Regal on Western and Fomax, and I thought it was a pretty brilliant experience. It's a huge clear screen without a lot of light bleed on it. I enjoy it there.
So what about substantively the responses here to a couple of Kyle's comments?
I think what he's talking about, that would be a great place to end it if this were a TV miniseries. Yeah. But I think there's probably too much story left.
Like a Marvel movie where the next several are already planned out. That's what it made
me think. Yeah, yeah. It's a cliffhanger. It's not necessarily a cliffhanger that feels like the end of half a story. So, yeah, I don't know.
I just don't think that you can walk out on a movie where I always come back to the TV show Smash, which is about people trying to put together a Broadway musical about the life of Marilyn Monroe. And there's this big plot beat in the first season where these extremely experienced Broadway writer and book writer, music writer people actually stage a version of the play that just ends with Marilyn Monroe dying on stage. You know, no song, no commentary, no anything, just, but she's dead now. Everybody can shuffle out in quiet. And they cannot figure out why it doesn't play. They're like, but that's how it ends. And I feel like the ending of, this movie ended with, okay, well, the Harkonnens killed just about everybody. The end, go home. People wouldn't necessarily want to come back. You know, it's a big downer ending to live with for 2-3 years, whatever. A movie like this that is heading into the next movie needs to give you something to hope for, like some reason to go back, whether it's we got to catch up with the hobbits that they're taking to Isengard or whatever. There's got to be some reason to come back. I just don't think it would have worked if it had ended earlier.
There are hobbits in this movie?
Yeah. Do you not remember that? Keith Chernoff in the middle of the film again.
Possible.
I love that Tasha's still keeping the Smash discourse alive.
It's one of those symbolic go-tos that I will just never let go of because it's so hilarious to me.
We should start the Smash cast. anyway,
you just want another excuse to say smash that subscribe button, Scott. Boy. I know you.
I do. I guess one thing I will say, I do think the film ends in the right spot. I mean, for one, we get some good action in that last bit. I mean, we do get to see Paul and Jessica escape, I guess, and that's kind of a thrilling sequence. And we see Paul, you know, kill someone for the first time and are left with that as well. So
we also get a lot of the desert, which is like really important, you know, like everything prior to that, like it's just, we only get glimpses. We don't spend sustained time in the desert. And, you know, as far as spectacle goes, like, yeah, we see the sandworm before that ending, but like we really see the sandworm, you know, after that assault. So like, I can't really get behind giving up all that for the sake of a third part.
We also, you know, get that all important moment where Paul actually makes a decision, where he actually takes action. And, you know, if we'd ended with the Harkonnen raid and people dying, there never really comes a point where he becomes a character. He's just a victim being carried along by events. So part of the promise of the next movie is like, okay, he's the reluctant messiah has stepped up instead of just sitting in the background saying, I don't wanna. He's made his first choice down the road that the movie keeps promising he's going to go on.
So in short, we're telling Kyle, thank you for enjoying the show, but you cannot see see Dune in IMAX, and we all disagree with your opinion.
Well, we have the first question.
Okay,
yeah,
the first part. Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
I agree with that.
Okay, there
certainly.
You go. So Liat Kynes, so hit me.
Although, I mean, I think that this movie downplays Liat's role.
Yes.
You don't really get that sense of her setting a bunch of things in motion or predicting a bunch of things, which is sad because then you don't get the great moment of Paul Atreides like standing up to the Fremen and telling them that he is their duke and them having no idea what that means and not caring until somebody comes in and says, as Liat foretold, and then they all cheer, which is just another like running joke in my life. I'm sorry that we do not get to spread the in joke as Liat foretold, which is something I say as people who follow my Twitter or speak to me in person know. I say that far too much, but Liat doesn't foretell a whole lot here. Like her importance is mostly backloaded into kind of the final moments of the movie, and I don't think she gets enough setup here to be the significant and important character that I think Kyle is kind of hoping she is here.
We'll learn about the Fremen's plans in the next movie. We don't necessarily, the character doesn't necessarily need to be around for us to kind of see what the overall scheme is. But we're getting ahead of ourselves there. We'll have to wait for another, what, two years for the next one to come out.
What?
But until then.
And don't worry. He's already saying that he's interested in Dune 3. It's just going to be, you know, continuing with the next book in the line.
Yeah, maybe so. We always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations and anything else Dune related. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll look at Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho, another wildly expressive psychodrama about two different women whose lives and identities converge. Look for that episode next Tuesday, or you can subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. If you want to hear it without ads, and while surrounded by extra Next Picture Show written and recorded content, come support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, please convince your doppelganger to smash that Next Picture Show subscribe button.
Smash!